Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Eradicating poverty is a noble cause, but how do we do it? And what is its impact on our communities? Radio commentator Tavis Smiley has made answering these questions his cause, and we'll chat with him about it a little bit later in this program. First, though, a chat with autism activist Temple Grandin. She's a remarkable woman who never let her autism disorder get in the way. She has a Ph.D., is a college professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and is a best-selling author. A few years ago, an award-winning film on HBO told her story. Temple Grandin was in St. Louis recently at the invitation of the UMSL Succeed program, and I had a long conversation with her at the Two Hill Performing Arts Center and began by asking what message she was bringing to our town.
Well, I'm talking about different kinds of minds. You know, when I was young, I thought everybody thought in pictures the same way that I think. And I've learned that some people think in patterns. Those are the mathematicians. Some people think in words. When I was a little kid, I had all the full symptoms of autism, no speech until age 4. You know, now I'm a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. And there's a lot of kids out there kind of geeky and nerdy and different. And I want to see them become really super successful.
What has to happen for that to happen?
One of the things is learning work skills. You know, being a child of the 50s, you had to be on time. At 13, my mother got me a sewing job working with a freelance seamstress. When I was 15, I was cleaning 8 horse stalls every day, basically running a horse barn. I was doing carpentry work. I was painting signs and selling them. By the time I graduated from college, I had a lot of work experiences. And today, you got some of these kids getting through college, never had a job. And that hurts the kids that are kind of different.
I want to get back to some of the things you just said, but you have a Ph.D. A lot of people might think that that is remarkable. Is it remarkable?
Well, there's other people on the autism spectrum that have Ph.D.s, quite a few, in fact. But where I'm seeing the biggest problem is getting and keeping jobs. And I can't emphasize enough, we need to start with paper route substitutes for middle school. It could be simple things like walking dogs. It could be a volunteer job at a church. But it has to be something where there's that discipline. You got to be there on time. You got to do it every day. And the other thing I'm seeing with a lot of kids is getting addicted to video games. And they're not having good outcomes. You know, playing video games 8 or 9 hours a day. And they're not becoming video game designers. Some of them are ending up on Social Security playing video games. I thought it was very interesting when I went out to Silicon Valley. And you got lots of people on the autism spectrum out there. And they've avoided the labels. They control the video game playing. You know, they're going to teach their kids programming when they're 7 years old.
But I think a lot of people may think the video games are babysitters, maybe?
Well, you got to control the video game playing, because if they're going on into great video game design jobs, things like that, I'd feel differently about it. But that's not the kind of outcomes that they're having. We've got to get these kids out doing things. And I had a lot of anxiety when I was a teenager. But one of the things the school parents wouldn't allow is becoming a recluse in my room. I had to be out doing things. And I got bullied and teased a lot in school. And the only places I was not bullied and teased were special interests, things like electronics, horseback riding. And the kids who were interested in specialized things like electronics were not the kids doing the teasing.
It sounds like things maybe haven't changed all that much.
Bullying is still a big problem.
Well, it's not that. I mean, in terms of the young people and how they're adjusting to whatever disability they might have.
Well, I think they get too much into the disability, because I'll go over to the meatpacking plant. In fact, half the cattle in this country handled equipment I designed for meatpacking plants. And when I was out all the time supervising installation of my facilities, there were people in the maintenance shop that I know are on the spectrum. I know people that run metal fabrication businesses that were saved by skilled trades. I'd say maybe 25% of the kids that are labeled ADHD, or dyslexic, or Asperger, a skilled trade is where they ought to be. We have a huge shortage right now in this country of diesel mechanics and auto mechanics. But a kid's not going to find out that he likes cars unless he gets a chance to work on them. Now, I don't know what the situation is here in St. Louis, but in a lot of states, they've taken those classes out, those hands-on classes. I think it's the worst thing that they've done. I was pleased to find out from the people backstage at the theater here that one of them was teaching a course in technical theater. That's all the backstage lighting and how to work all the different curtains and things like that.
Well, what you're saying is that there's nothing, really, that these kids can't do.
Well, they tend to have specialized skills. I had a terrible time with algebra. But you don't need algebra to fix cars or to do millwright work. All the algebra you need is going to be in computer programs. You do need your sixth grade math. That you do need. And we got to be looking at what the kid can do. He is going to have to read at the USA Today level, do a skilled trade. You see, when you design a product, even a product like an iPhone, Steve Jobs was an artist. Okay, so he comes up with the interface, and he comes up with that thing of pinching the picture to make it small and, you know, moving your hand to make the picture big and small. He thought up that idea. That's the art side. And then the engineer, the mathematician, had to figure out how to make that work. You see, that's the mathematical mind working together with the art kind of mind. And other people tend to be verbal thinkers. We got to find out what they're good at. But one of the big things I got to emphasize is they got to learn work skills, just that discipline of being on time. I was just talking to the people here running the program here at the college, and a girl picked out an internship, and it was an 8-week internship, and she decided she didn't like it. And they said, well, you've got to finish it. You've got to finish that 8-week program. Now you don't have to do it again. But that's part of the discipline of work.
And whose responsibility is that? Is it the parents? Is it the school teacher? Is it the local preacher?
I'm seeing too much helicopter parents. You know, when I was a young child, I mean, I was out shopping by myself. I learned how to order food in restaurants. I see too many helicopter moms and kind of afraid to let go of the kid. I talked to one family one time when I was at a delayed flight. That boy was 15 years old, absolutely fully verbal. He was doing Lego videos in his room, and their church had some video that needed to be edited. And I said, he needs to edit that video. And then I said, he needs to do it in the church office. We got to get him out of the house. And mom started to get kind of upset and said she couldn't let go. And I said, you got to let go. This kid's not going to develop. We got to get them out doing things.
There seem to be so many myths and misunderstandings about people who are within this umbrella spectrum, if you will.
See, the problem with autism is it goes all the way from Steve Jobs and half the computer programmers in Silicon Valley to somebody who can't dress themselves. There would be no radio station right now if it wasn't for some autism genes. There'd be no computers. You see, a brain can either be made more thinking or cognitive, or a brain can be made more social-emotional. In the mild forms of autism, it's just personality variant. In more severe forms, yeah, some of them are very handicapped, can't talk, maybe have epilepsy on top of the autism. It's a very, very big spectrum. But on the mild end of the spectrum, it's your geeks and nerds. And I've been out to Silicon Valley. I've been to places like Microsoft and Google. You know, they tend to avoid the labels out there, but they're the same geeks. And then you look at all the NASA stuff. Those engineers, a lot of them are on the spectrum. Yep. Then I talked to old NASA granddads, retired from NASA. They've got autistic grandkids. You see, that's the genetic side of it.
You talk about bullying earlier. How much of a problem is that really, and how damaging is that to the person being bullied?
Well, it's very bad. And when I was in high school, I had a horrible time with that. And the only place I could get away from bullying was specialized interests like horses and model rockets and electronics. This is why it's so important to get kids into things like Lego Mindstorms, Maker Community Clubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. Theater is another great thing to get them into. Dance, music, art. These are also things that can turn into careers. And then there's some kids, maybe they're bullied so bad in school, you got to pull them out of school. But then they need to finish up online. They need to get a job. No recluses in the home. You finish up school online, you're going to work. Even if it's just pushing carts in the grocery store, you've got to get out of the house and learn how to work.
Well, how are employers with regard to this? Are there people out there who kind of shy away from these people?
Well, I learned how to sell jobs by showing off my portfolio. You know, people respect ability. So I'd show off my drawings. I'd show off photographs of things I had designed. Okay, if you're a programmer, you put up on your LinkedIn site or you put up on programming forum. Oh, this is a magic word, forum. You type that into Google. It could be sewing forum, theater forum. Use that magic word forum and put up things for your resume, artwork, programming, things you can show off. And I would show drawings off and people would go, wow, then they would hire me. And then I'd write articles about some of the things I had built.
You have to sell yourself just like anybody has to.
Well,
but the potential
thing is, interview, you come across poorly, so I just sell my portfolio. I just laid my portfolio out on the table. Well, now, of course, you might have an iPad or something like that, but you still be showing off your work.
I'd like to back up a little bit to something we've talked before. We talked several years ago, and you probably don't remember it, but I do. And you mentioned this a few moments ago with regard to the way you think. You think in pictures.
Yes, I do.
Remind our audience what that really means, and explain that. Explain what you see.
Well, it's sort of like Google for images. You can put in a keyword, and it's associative. Now, give me some keywords, something not common. Don't give me house or car. You know, everybody can visualize their own home or their own car. Give me a keyword. Pretend I'm like Google for images, and I'll tell you how images come up in my mind.
Microphone.
It's here in the room. Give me something that's not here in the room.
Helicopter.
Helicopter. I'm actually seeing there's two helicopters to see quite often. There's one out on I-25 near our experiment station, place that makes helicopters. There's another helicopter on the roof of the hospital that I go by. There's another one at another place. I don't know what they do with that helicopter. It's a green helicopter. Now I'm seeing some helicopters from old movies.
So what are you doing with it? You're seeing these pictures.
I'm bringing them up, you know, pictures sequentially. They come up like a still picture, and then I can make it move. Okay, now I'm looking at the hospital, and I see the helicopter sitting there on the roof. Now I can make that helicopter take off in my mind because I know what a helicopter looks like when it takes off.
But if we're having a conversation and I use the word helicopter, are all of these images going through your mind?
Well, I'm also seeing a mom now at an autism conference that's doing all the talking for her kid, and that's a helicopter parent.
So that's how you're tying all of these things
together.
Well,
yeah, because I first started to see helicopters are real things that fly. But the term helicopter has also been used to describe parents that, you know, make all the decisions for their kids and just sort of hover over them.
Is this going on? Are these images going on all the time?
Well, then there might be images for something else. You know, other things we've talked about, I tend to get images up.
You've been seeing things as we've been talking here?
That's right. Like, for example, talking about skilled trades, talking about my drawings. When I talked about that, I saw the drawings.
What would happen if you didn't see those pictures?
Well, the words narrate the pictures. That's how I think. I think in pictures. Then you get the mathematician. They don't think in pictures. They think in patterns. Think origami. Think organic chemistry formulas, mathematics. It's patterns rather than pictures. But we need the different kinds of minds because I was horrified and shocked when I found out why the Fukushima nuclear power plant burned up. It was a visual thinking mistake. And what I've learned is the mathematicians did not see. Well, what happened is they put the emergency cooling pump and all the generators that run the emergency cooling pump in a non-waterproof basement. So when the tsunami came, well, those generators got flooded underwater. They don't work underwater. Simple watertight doors, and it would not have happened. But what I've learned is the engineer doesn't see it.
Did you figure this out just by reading stories?
Well, I figured it out kind of by questioning people about how they think. You see, I used to think everybody with autism thought in pictures, and I wrote my first book, Thinking in Pictures. Then I got reviews on Amazon. This would have been 20 years ago, saying, oh, no, I don't think in pictures. And then I started questioning people about how they think. And I'd say, think about a church steeple. How does it come into your mind? And I was shocked to find out that some people got a very vague, generalized, pointy thing. I don't get that. I just see specific ones. There is no pointy thing.
This is not something that can be taught, or can it?
Well, there's a certain amount of flexibility. You know, if you sort of look at the length of a table might be the whole spectrum of visual thinking, and I'm way down on the right-hand side, or you have somebody that's a word thinker and they're way down on the left-hand side, you're not going to get them all the way over to the right-hand side. Mm. You can move them a bit along it. There's definitely some plasticity. But most people, if I ask you, think about your own house, can see it. But when I ask you something you don't own, that's when people tend to get the more vague image. But I can usually force most people to think much more specific.
How did you use this and how do you use it with regard to the work you've done with animals?
Well, some of the very first work I did with animals is I noticed that cattle would stop and refuse to move through a chute if there was a reflection on it, a rope across it, a vehicle parked next to it, a hose on the ground. And it just was obvious. And other people just don't tend to see that. I was looking at little things that the cattle were seeing. I have a slide that I show of an animal looking at a sunbeam. When I show that to a bunch of children, half the hands go up. They see it. And I showed it to a bunch of mathematicians. No hands went up.
Which tells you?
They're a pattern thinker. That's why they're mathematicians.
Let's talk a little bit more about the work with animals. I mean, you've worked in, I guess, slaughterhouses is the best way to put it.
I've worked a long time on improving how animals are handled. I developed a very simple scoring system for assessing slaughterhouses. Instead of telling you how to build them, let's see how they perform. You've got animals bellowing, you're poking them, each animal, a whole bunch of times, an electric prod. That's really terrible. Broken equipment. You know, slaughterhouse that works right, they just walk up the chute like going in the veterinary chute. Bang, it's done. when it's working right. And if you want to see how it works, you can go online and look at Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. I also have a website, grandin.com. And while we're talking about books and things, we talked about the different kinds of minds. I described that in my book, The Autistic Brain, that I also did with Richard Panik. And I actually have scientific studies in that book that show that there are visual thinking minds and then more pattern or mathematical minds.
We'll put links to those websites and the other information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. I'm going to take a break now. We're talking with Dr. Temple Grandin. We're talking about her work in the world of autism and the autism spectrum. We'll be back in just a moment to continue the conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And we are back to continue our conversation with Dr. Temple Grandin. Just before we took the break, we were talking about your work with animals. You are an animal lover.
Yes.
Any problems with you working with the animals that were going to their doom?
Well, I've done a lot of thinking about that. And the cattle that we raise for food, pigs we raise for food, have never been born at all. We hadn't raised them. And I feel very strongly we've got to give those animals a life worth living. And when I see a problem now at a slaughter plant, it's more likely to be a problem I have to fix back at the farm. Like, for example, a dairy might let a dairy cow get too skinny and emaciated before they bring her in, or lameness problems in dairy animals and beef animals. That's, sore feet. These are things that are going to have to be fixed at the farm. And good ranchers, good stock people, I've seen good stock people that really care about their animals. They're starting to get to be a lot more interest now in low-stress stockmanship, handling cattle quietly. When I first started in the 70s and 80s, handling cattle was absolutely awful. You know, the bad old days were really, really, really bad. I've been around for many, many years.
Now, haven't we all? But, you know, when you speak about today's farm, what we're talking about in so many cases are the industrial farms, where these animals are kept under conditions I'm sure you would deplore.
Well, some large farms are good. Mm. I went to 4 really good dairies in the last year, and they were huge dairies. They're going now with a smaller cow that lasts longer, has fewer problems. Good dairies, you don't have a lot of lame cows. A lot of things have to do with how it's managed.
In some cases, the way it's managed with regards to chickens, for instance, and pigs, they're put in places where they can't move.
There are some things that need to be changed. And pigs and chickens are where you have the most issues, where some things need to be changed.
That bothers you.
Yeah, keeping a pig in a stall where it can't turn around for most of its life, that needs to be changed. And you need to differentiate between the gestation stall where the pregnant cells are kept, where she can't turn around, the farrowing stall where she has the little piglets. But there's some things they have to change, and Smithfield's already working on changing that over.
The World Health Organization may have been giving cattle and pigs and chickens a new lease on life with their disclosure last week that these things are potential carcinogens and that people should not be eating so much of these.
Well,
products.
This water bottle has got potential endocrine disruptors in it. Right after I read that, I went and had 6 pieces of bacon off the hotel buffet. I mean, everything's going to be causing cancer now. There's a point where I just can't worry about it. I think the biggest thing we've got to worry about is obesity. When they started doing the low-fat pasta and spaghetti, that healthy diet, I gained a whole lot of weight. I find the only way I can control weight. I don't do strict Atkins. That's kind of crazy. But I've got to limit carbs. Otherwise, I just put the weight on. And I think the obesity, we need to be doing something about that.
No question about it. One of the big health problems in the country today. Where else does the world of autism and animal science intersect?
Well, being a visual thinker has helped me in work with animals because animals are sensory-based. Their memories are going to be pictures. Their memories are going to be sounds, smells, touch sensations. I mean, the dog checks out the local tree. That's like going down to the coffee shop. In fact, I talk about this in my book, Animals in Translation. And if you want to understand animal behavior, you've got to get away from verbal language. Now, anyone who's working with animals, it's very important. Okay, you introduce a horse or a dog to something new. Make sure that it's a good experience. Because if an animal has a really bad first experience with something new, like a horse trailer, let's say fell down in it the first time went in the horse trailer, then he's likely to be afraid of it. And you can get fear memories. And you can get fear memories that are associated with something the animal is either seeing or hearing right the moment that the bad thing happened. And in my book, Animals in Translation, I talk about the black hat horse. Black cowboy hats were associated with being abused during a veterinary procedure. White hats are fine. Animal thinking is specific because it's sensory-based.
Just like in the movies, black hats belong to the bad guys and white hats belong to the good guys.
You know, this has been verified by a German experiment that was done by Lehner and Fendt. They found that if you train a horse to tolerate a blue and white umbrella opening suddenly, that doesn't automatically transfer to an orange tarp flapping all around. Think about it. A blue and white umbrella looks totally different than a tarp flapping all around. People will say to me, oh, my horse was fine at home and he went crazy at the show. But you got a lot of stuff at the show that you don't have at home, like flags, bikes, and balloons. And the best way to get an animal trained to tolerate something like flags would be to decorate the pasture fence with flags and let the horse voluntarily approach. New things are attractive if the animal can voluntarily approach. They're scary if you suddenly just shove it in their face.
What about red capes and bulls?
Animals are red color blind. Birds have full color vision. Primates have full color vision. Cattle and dogs, there's no red receptor. They see yellow and blue and green just fine.
Do you do any work with household pets, dogs, cats?
I haven't been doing any recently. I did quite a bit of work with antelopes at the Denver Zoo, and we trained antelopes at the Denver Zoo to cooperate with blood sampling, and that reduces a lot of stress, but it's a very flighty animal. So just to train it to tolerate a sliding door suddenly opening took 10 days. First day, we move the door 1 inch, like, shh, and it orients, and it looks. Well, that's all we did that day. Mm-hmm. Next day, we move the door 2 inches, and then it oriented. See, when the animal orients, then the brain makes a decision. Do I keep watching, or am I going to get scared and run off?
So what advice do you have for pet owners?
It's so important to socialize puppies. You've got to socialize dogs. Animals reared alone will often fight other animals in a very dangerous way.
Pardon me, socialize them with other dogs.
Other dogs, other people. It's also very important to socialize puppies and dogs that toddlers are people too. Because if a dog never gets introduced to toddlers, he might treat that toddler as prey, and that's very dangerous if it's a large dog. So puppies need to be taken over to the daycare and learn that toddlers are people and the children have to be handle the puppy gently, so it's a good experience for the puppy. But it's important for dogs to get out and socialize with other dogs, socialize with lots of other people.
You know, I've always heard that the dogs and animals don't get jealous. That's a human quality. But, I've seen some things and had some observations that makes me think otherwise. What do you think?
Well, they certainly sometimes don't like it when another animal gets attention.
Or when the new baby comes in, as you mentioned a moment ago, the dog could be jealous of
the baby. Well, I think one of the ways is that puppies need to be brought up that, you know, babies and toddlers are people too. So that if a baby is brought in, it's not something totally new.
It's really pretty simple, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty commonsensical.
When I was a child, all the dogs ran loose in the neighborhood. And the downside is that you had dogs killed by cars. But on the good side of it, we didn't have all these behavior problems. Because the dogs were all socialized. We didn't have dogs home alone chewing up furniture, chewing up the house because they were home alone. They were out in their doggy social world.
I'd like to change the subject slightly now and go to a subject you may like to talk about. I would think you would, and that is the HBO movie about you for which Claire Danes won an Emmy, I should say.
She did a great job. She kind of became me. And the thing I really liked about the movie is they showed my visual thinking accurately. They showed all my projects. They showed important people like my mother, Mr. Carlock, my science teacher. He was an important mentor. They showed Anne, my aunt, out at the ranch. And they showed all the things I built. All the projects were real. And I think that's important because I'm really concerned that a lot of these kids are getting these labels, ADHD, autism, or whatever. Don't get hung up on these labels. Half of Silicon Valley's on the spectrum, and they avoid the labels. And they've got good jobs because we've got to get these kids doing paper route substitutes starting in middle school. They can walk dogs for the neighbors. There's a lot of different things they can be doing. As soon as they're 16, they need to just get a job in the economy, like work in a grocery store. Because one of the things they got to learn is that discipline of a job. You got to be there on time for work.
Back to the movie for a moment. How did all of that come about?
Well, Emily Gerson Sains is an acting agent in New York. She has a severely autistic child who's nonverbal. She came to me about 10 years before the movie came out, the idea of doing the movie. And it took a long time to get the right team of people together. And she really wanted it to be right. That was one of those projects that really got done right.
And what role did you play in that in terms of as a consultant, as being heavily involved in the overall production?
Well, I read all the scripts, and I was very heavily involved to make sure all the cattle stuff was accurate. And I loved the fact that my drawings appeared in the movie. Actual real drawings used to build real jobs are in that movie.
And the actress who played you, Claire, did you have any role in her selection?
They picked her out, and when I first saw her online, I'm going, you got to be kidding, blonde. Well, they stuffed her hair up under a wig. In fact, Mick Jackson, the director, wanted her to cut her hair and dye it, and she wasn't going to do that. She'd already done a whole lot of acting before he even found out that it was a wig. It was such a good wig. But Claire became me. She's such a good actress. I spent 4 or 5 hours with her, and then I gave her all these ancient old VHS tapes, oldest ones I could find, and she used those to model me, you know, and she practiced how I talked. She practiced how I moved. She became me.
I saw a video today of her receiving that award and the compliments that she made to you. You were in the audience that night.
Yep.
I think it was a big surprise that she actually won. She had some pretty stiff competition.
Yeah, and she did such a good job. It won 7 Emmys. 5 were given at the awards night. There was an Emmy for Best One-Camera Editing and for Music Score. But she just did a fantastic job. It's just so exciting. Nobody knows who's going to win until they break open that little cardboard folder.
How has it helped you, and how has it helped your work?
Well, I have people coming up to me all the time, and I've had kids do projects about me, and I get letters from a lot of students that I'm motivating them to succeed. I think that's really a good thing. People ask me all the time, how do you feel about all these people recognizing you at the airport? And I say, it's a responsibility.
What do you think your greatest success has been after all these years?
Well, there's a lot of things. You know, I can remember getting started in the cattle industry. It was really tough being a woman in a man's field in the 70s. Oh, autism, that was a non-issue. Being a girl in a man's field in the 70s was really, really difficult. That wasn't an easy thing to do.
Some women, even today, are having a difficult time in men's
fields. Oh, what they call harassment today is like little nothing compared to what I went through. And they really did put bull testicles on my vehicle. That actually happened. That stuff in the movie is true.
And how did you handle it?
I just threw them off, and I went down to the farmer ranchman and asked him if I could do a column.
A column?
Yep. I'd written one article for him. Thought the way to get my revenge against Scottsdale Feed Yard was to get a press pass, and then they'd have to let me into things.
And have things changed very much for the better now?
Oh, absolutely. When I started out in the 70s, there were no women working in feed yards, you know, with the cattle. They were only in the office. Now there's many women working in these fields. In the field of animal science, there's many, many women. Now, a lot of them are pre-vet, but there's many people, women now working in the meat plants in jobs like quality assurance, management jobs. I've done a lot of work for Cargill. They've had a woman manager. Another plant that I worked with had a manager that ran the slaughter floor, and she was, you know, a go-getter. She was 10 years younger than me. And then she came in there, they gave her the worst job on the floor because they wanted to run her off, and she just stuck with it.
Well, our time is just about up, but I wanted to ask you what you consider to be your biggest challenges right now, whether it be in the field of animal science or in the field of autism and education.
Well, I do a lot of different things. I've made a point of on my talks. I like to do an autism talk, and then I like to go out and do talk to people like at NASA or Silicon Valley, and then I do a cattle talk, and then I was a training instructor for animal welfare at the meatpacking plant. I like jumping between the silos because one thing that really worries me is I'm seeing too many geeky kids that in my generation were just called geeks and nerds, ones with no speech delay. They're getting too much into these labels, getting addicted to video games, and they're not getting good jobs. And then I go over to the meatpacking plant, and there's a whole shop full of old hippies my age, and I know they're on the spectrum. Well, there's the weird welding guy that's really good or another guy that does design work, and he's really good, and I know he's on the spectrum. You know, that's why I like going back and forth between the silos. People need to work on trying to bust out of the silos.
When you say you know someone's on the spectrum, is that something that you have been told or can you detect it?
Oh, I can tell. I can tell a geek when I see one.
How?
You see, the problem you've got with autism is it goes from Steve Jobs and Einstein. Einstein would be labeled autistic today. No speech until age 3. So you're going from sort of geeky to somebody who can't dress themselves. They got movement disorder, epilepsy, and all kinds of other things on top of the autism. And when they changed the guidelines in 2013, you've got this huge spectrum that need very, very different kinds of surfaces. And you see, being a visual thinker, I see specific cases. I'm going, oh, I saw this big football player. He's collecting, playing video games and Social Security. It was right during the oil boom. He should have been out in an oil rig doing some roughnecking. Uh-huh. He was a big football player. They like those kind of guys.
Sure, they absolutely do. One final question. This always comes up whenever we're talking about autism or the spectrum, and that is the vaccine issue.
I'm not even going to discuss that because that distracts from all the things I'm interested in, like education, people getting good jobs and being successful.
Well, I just bring it up because everyone does, and it's been so widely discredited.
I'm not going to discuss it. Look it up on Google Scholar.
We'll end it on that note. Temple Grandin, thanks so much for being with us.
Well,
welcome to St. Louis.
It's been good to be here.
Coming up, Tavis Smiley. He's in town later this week for a conference on community issues related to poverty, and he's next. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.